Well, I first fell in love with Olympia Brown in seminary, and even though I was a married man at the time, my wife did not object too much. I was the only person who identified as male who took a fine class on women in American religious history. Professors noted that if you put black in the title of a class, only black people or people who thought of themselves as black would attend. And if you put women in the title of a class, only women would show up. But I was there. The major presentation that they'd chosen for the end of the class was to write about a significant woman and then to become that figure and answer questions from the professors in the class in person. However, they would not allow me to become Olympia. They decided that I had to become her husband, the newspaper man, Mr. John Henry Willis. Willis supported Olympia in all her work. And he also loved Olympia. Olympia was most significant for being the first woman fully ordained. There were other women who were given preaching licenses or preaching ordination, but never served congregations. There were other women who had led congregations since the time of the Apostle Paul, we know. But she was the first to graduate from a theological school. She was the first to be ordained with full denominational authority. She was the first woman to serve several congregations over several decades. And then she gave up parish ministry and worked for just as long to get the women the vote. I don't simply want you to love her and to know her. I want you to catch something of her hopeful spirit, her religious vision. And it was from her religious vision that she derived her perseverance, her courage, her determination and drive. She was faced with constant resistance, constant difficulty and setbacks, and that she could rise superior to such difficulties and disillusionments. As Gwendolyn Willis, her granddaughter, said, that was the consequence of a hopefulness and courage with which she was richly endowed. In full disclosure, she was also very indomitable. She was uncompromising. She was tough as nails. She cared very little for cultured society. She paid no deference to wealth. She represented what was growing to be an unfashionable denomination, and she promoted a cause of women's suffrage, which was regarded as certain to fail. And yet she kept going, she kept serving all her days, from the 1840s until the 1920s. What was it that drove her? What was it that gave her that spirit, hopefulness, and a positive energy that just kept her moving, flowing like that river in her soul? Some say it was the frontier spirit. Her parents, Lefia and Asa Brown, were farmers. Asa Brown were farmers in what was then considered frontier land in Wisconsin. There in the frontier, women were equal to men. Men took on women's tasks, women took on men's tasks. It was very clear that for survival, everyone had to work together and everyone's work was equally respected and valued. They all worked together, and that sense of equality inspired Olympia, carried her forward. She knew what it was like when two people of different genders fully worked together in respect and partnership, equal partnership. Her work for suffrage, for women, the women's right to vote, began very early in her life. She took a sabbatical from her first congregation in Weymouth to work for suffrage in Kansas. The proposal had come up that Kansas would grant the vote within Kansas elections for women. There were lecture sites and other arrangements that were supposed to have been made, but they were not made adequately. And she had to struggle to set things up, she would get to a town and suddenly had to figure out where she's going to live, where she was going to preach, what she was going to say, and then move on to the next city and do it over and over again. She took there, and every time there were people who met her, sometimes were there at the coach. It was stagecoaches at that time, would meet her at the stagecoach station in order to resist her, to tell her to leave. There were people who were quickly organized to discredit her. She took such obstacles as challenges to be surmounted always and kept her eyes firmly on her goal. She believed completely in the reasonableness, the equal reasonableness and goodness of men, that they was just as equal to women, that they would just be as reasonable as women and as capable of understanding justice as women. And so she spoke clearly and passionately to those who, in whose hands was women's vote, to the men. She was in unbearable heat, in brutal winds, difficult conditions, a tireless worker. She persevered and mounted a spirited campaign, delivered more than 300 speeches. When only one-third of the voting population at that time voted for the proposition, she felt that it was a victory, it was a success. And when Susan B. Anthony wrote to her, she said, "I congratulate you in this glorious triumph." There's something about her spirit that encouraged people to be positive, optimistic, hopeful. Some say it wasn't just the equality of the frontier and the toughness of the frontier, it was her own mother. Her mother was a universalist, lifelong universalist, and she was passionate about education, especially for her own children. Their primary education was largely at Lefia's hand. Then Olympia went first to a school called Mount Holyoke. She found it not to her liking. There were way too many rules and a very oppressive religious spirit there. But then she heard about Antioch, the Unitarian educator Horace Mann was president there. And though she was Universalist her whole life, many of her friends and many of her associates and colleagues were Unitarians. For we were really never very different from one another, the Unitarians and Universalists in this country. Her family actually moved to Yellow Springs to ensure a better education for all of the children because of the positive experience she had there in Yellow Springs at Antioch. Olympia graduated with her bachelor's from Antioch in 1860. But some say it wasn't just her mother, it wasn't just the frontier, it was really the spirit of God that comes through the universalist vision, one that was positive and hopeful. And so her first goal was the ministry. She said, "During the years of my college work, I've been gradually forming a determination to become a preacher. Ever since my experience at Mount Holyoke, I'd been anxious to tell the truth about the doctrine of endless punishment. I vainly supposed that if people could only be told that there was no such thing as everlasting punishment, as it was then literally preached, they would be rejoiced. Such was the ignorance of the world in which I had grown up, that I had been astounded at the religious teachings administered at Mount Holyoke and shocked at their repulsive, negative character. I had slight conception of the widespread character of the superstitions to which people clung in the belief that they were essential to religion. I knew nothing then of the difficulties I was to experience later, and it was well that I did not, or I should hardly have had the courage to enter on the course I was planning." When she was in seminary, there were some of her fellow students who would mock her. There was a couple of young men who often stood outside of her window when she was practicing, and they would mock her high-pitched female voice. "Thus saith the Lord," they'd yell from the windows. She accepted that this was part of being the first woman to ever go to seminary. She did note in her autobiography later that the worst in her class, those who were the meanest to her, did not stay in the Universalist ministry. She said they were not of a character fitting to good ministry. She took voice lessons. She learned to speak extemporaneously and passionately. Usually she spoke without a manuscript, so we do not have many of her sermons. About all that trouble and resistance she found, she said, "I was determined to make the best of it." And I see that spirit in this church, that determination. Those who came through the long years of transition, those who will carry the church forward through this time of change in American culture about religion, that spirit of dedication, that vision of the beloved community, that hopefulness, but also a hard as nails determination to just keep doing the work no matter what, to keep doing the work. Olympia Brown was on the editing committee of the Women's Bible. It was published in 1896 and 98. Talks about liberal interpretation of the Bible and struck directly at the entire idea that the Bible had clearly, without any equivocation, established the dominance of men over women. And over and over, through many essays written by many people, edited, and all these women. There was, I think there was a panel of more than 20 editorial women. I was just reading through even Robert Ingersoll's wife was a member of that editorial board. Looking at the Bible, they understood the Bible very well, wrote about it clearly and eloquently, undermining that idea and holding up an idea of equality, of possibility, of dignity and change. Olympia was not only a universalist, she was also non-Trinitarian, or thus Unitarian in her Christian theology. She had a sermon entitled, "There is One God," which drew on lines from Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, and 1 Timothy. And she said, "The Old Testament teems with prophecies about the Messiah, but nowhere is it intimidated the Messiah is to stand as a God to be worshipped. He's to bring peace on earth. He's to build up the waste places, to comfort the brokenhearted. But nowhere is he spoken of as a deity. There is only one God by whom all things were made, and we are in him made one. He has created us in our image, in his image, endowed us with the grandest of capabilities. Let us live by those capabilities." Then, as now, she preached about the possibilities of human beings, the capabilities and qualities of human beings, and the possibilities that we had to make this world a shinier and better place. She had resistance. A congregation that she served between Weymouth and Racine was a difficult one. There was a small group of people there in that congregation, even though the majority of the congregation is for her. There was a small group that had opposed her from the very beginning. They voted against her when the first vote came, and they just continually agitated against her. And yet she still strengthened that congregation. She still increased its vitality and capabilities. And when she moved on to Racine, which is her longest standing congregation, she went with encouragement and support and great energy. And of course, she had found her husband, her partner for 20 years, her true love. Now, I've mentioned several times, and we've talked a lot about the fact that she was a woman and she was opposed by men. One of the things that we've been coming to understand in recent decades is that there are not simply two genders. There's a term cisgender. Does anyone know the term cisgender? Is anyone familiar with that? There's a small scattering of us who've encountered that. Cisgender is a person, a cisgendered person is someone who identifies fully and completely with the gender they were given at birth. Of course, the gender is given by society. Your sex, even, is determined often by society. There are only two sexes. And as we have looked at human biology, as we have looked at the nature of human character, we begin to find that there are many, many varieties and variations. It's not a simple binary reality. I remember a man who was obviously enamored with women. He was very romantic and flirty with women. He was very much a male. He had several children. One of his oldest son was my best friend. But he was very much an effeminate, very light in his style, liked to dress snappy, had a light voice. He was clearly a male, and yet not clearly a male by the standards of our culture and our society. Olympia was a woman who was in very many ways cisgender. She believed that she identified with herself as a woman, but she did not identify with many of the cultural assumptions that were given to that gender. She showed a variety and a variation, a strength of character, a courage, a determination that was usually only applied to men. She was very irritated with the second generation of women suffragists who came in. Many of them were trying much harder to be respectable and to do social things and to be raised up in estimation in society. And she felt that she just really felt she had no time for that kind of activity. That's why she was so excited when the much more rebellious and radical party was created in 1913. She knew you had to be tough. You had to be strong, you had to be courageous if you were going to get anywhere. And though she had struggled, in a sense, with failure for her entire life to get equality of women, still she persevered. And she persevered because she had this religious vision, this understanding that all human beings were created equal, that there was an inherent level of worth and dignity in every individual. So we're trying to expand our understanding of what that means as we move into a world where there are gay and lesbian people, where there are bisexual and transgender people, where there are gender queer and gender alternative or non-gendered people. We're still struggling to find the worth and dignity of people, to give them find the capabilities that each person has, and to enhance those capabilities and let them flow, to say, like that river that flows in the heart, I am somebody. Our closing words today are from that sermon that she gave, that lifting of the gates sermon that she gave after women had achieved the vote. She went back to Racine, and she preached from the pulpit in the church there. And there she held up again the same foundation, the worth and dignity and the potential equality of beings rose from this deep faith that God was this power and this truth that created the foundations of the world, and that those foundations were ones of dignity and love and justice. And when she got the vote, she did not rest on her laurels. She immediately started work and founded the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, because she understood that all of her vision of a world made fair with all its people, one required her to keep moving, to keep working, to keep struggling. In a sermon that she gave a few years before that, she said, "We never can make the world safe by fighting. Every nation must learn that the people of all nations are children of God. And they need to just share the wealth of the world. You may say that this is impracticable, it's far away, can never be accomplished, but it is the work we are appointed to do. Somehow, sometime, somewhere, we must ever teach this great lesson. We can never make the world safe by fighting." In 1963, the theological school at St. Lawrence University unveiled a plaque, and it reads in part, "Olympia Brown, preacher of universalism, pioneer and champion of women's citizenship rights, forerunner of a new era, the flame of her spirit still burns today."